Welcome to RPG Storytime, the channel where we take stories generated out of role-playing games and narrate them in short, digestible segments. Today we continue Gangbusters, the 1920s game of mysteries, mobsters, and mayhem. The module is Murder in Harmony by Mark Akers. Private investigator Dylan Griebel has been hired to steal documents from a man named Will Feynman and return them to the affluent Betty Overton. Betty has just become a widow, and Dylan is more interested in how that came to be and why she wants those papers so soon after her husband's untimely demise. Detective Griebel has teamed up with reporter A.J. True to get to the bottom of this mystery, and together they have discovered that the Overton lawyer has committed the murder. But why he did it is inside a notebook that is locked away inside a locker at the train station. Returning to the paper to tell her boss, A.J. is horrified to witness his murder in a drive-by shooting right in front of her. We join Dylan Griebel as he pulls up to the scene. My first thought when I see all the black and whites is that Wilson jumped the gun and got the cops involved. That's the last thing I want, because then I won't have leverage. That's something the do-gooders never understand. The world doesn't run on a code of ethics. You need to make your own hand and then deal the cards after you have the royal flush. Then I see why the cops are really there, and I realize that him telling them about the notebook is the second to last thing I want. I park at a distance and stay in the car, peeking through the crowd as best I can to see if I can spot AJ's body. Did they kill her or kidnap her? If the latter, will they call me or the newspaper for her ransom? I regret more and more showing her that I have the key. Then my passenger door opens and I draw my gun. AJ drops into the passenger seat, her face soaked in tears. She doesn't even seem to notice my gun until I'm putting it away. Through gasps and tears, she tells me all about it. She managed to have the presence of mind to write down the license plate number and description of the two men in the car, as well as she could see them. It was enough. I remembered them from earlier in the day. They had pushed past me at the Lexington Hotel when I was heading in and they were heading out. As I think more about them, I realize that I've seen them before in cases that involved the mob. They certainly have the build for it. But I don't know who they are or who they work for. I vocalized some of this to AJ and she could not care any less. I don't want any part of this. I joined the newspaper to learn stories and share them, not to make bribes or gain leverage or sneak into people's houses or to undermine my integrity. If that's the price I must pay, then I'm done with all of it. I don't have a response to her. I'm not going to give her the rousing speech to keep her involved. If she's done with this, who am I to stop her? She exits the car and leaves, disappearing into the gathered crowd. I turn around and drive away. I pass by the train station without stopping. This isn't my job. I wasn't hired to solve a murder or break up a mob war. My job is to steal some documents, and that's exactly what I'm going to do. After this bottle of scotch. I scope out the Lexington Hotel, finding where room 503 is. I then find where its window faces. I'm lucky that it faces the alley. Then again, it makes sense. A man that doesn't want to be found doesn't want his window facing a major street. So it works in both our favors. I wait for dark, then push a dumpster to a point underneath the fire escape. I need to buy some time, so I go back to the lobby and pay a bellhop to take a message to room 503. He is to tell Feynman that Mrs. Overton is waiting for him in the lobby and refuses to leave until she sees him. As he heads upstairs, I go around back, climb onto the dumpster, then the fire escape, and make my way up to the room. I get there just as the front door is closing. Perfect timing. I give it a moment, though, to let him get down the hall so he doesn't hear me. I spend the time placing my jacket on the glass so it will muffle the sound. Then I punch it. The glass breaks with more sound than I'd like, but I don't hesitate. I reach in and unlatch the window, pull it up, and climb in while I put my jacket back on. The lights are off, and I leave them that way. There's enough light from outside to see. I go through the room in an organized fashion, checking each drawer, closet, every storage place. I find myself checking the same spot more than once. That was some good scotch. I'm running out of time, and I'm wasting it with unproductive searching, so I stop. I breathe. I think. He has no safe, but he rarely leaves. When would he be most at risk? And where would he keep it during that time? Answers. When he's asleep. So it'd be in the bed. I check under the mattress and there it is. I grab the folder without hesitation. I open it briefly to make sure. I see Betty Overton's name. Good enough for me. I feel around a little more briefly, then hurry to the window again. I scoot the glass under an end table to make it less obvious. Then I leave the window open, but I close the curtain. Feynman will obviously figure it out, but this will buy a little time. I use it to hop down several steps at a time as I rush down the fire escape. Once in the alley, I hurry to the street, then I casually mingle with the crowds. I go through the papers at my office while I finish off that scotch. There isn't much. Some old love letters from Betty to Will, a couple photographs, and a marriage certificate. She and Will were already married before she married Arthur. My guess is there are no divorce papers to go along with it, which means she would inherit nothing if this got out. So it was blackmail, and she wanted the evidence. Well, my job is done. Tomorrow I'll collect my money and wipe my hands of it. I sit back and listen to the radio. The news is abuzz about the growing mob war. I can even hear the occasional gunshot outside the window, all because each side thinks the other has the notebook. But what's inside it that's worth any of this? I know that most of it is revenge killings, and at this point the original reason is probably a moot point. But a knock rattles my door. I grab my .45 and keep it close. It's probably not danger. Danger would have already shot. But I'm keeping it close anyway. I pull the door just a crack, ready to slam it shut again if it's trouble. It's definitely trouble, but not the kind I need to slam the door on. It's AJ with a bottle of something.
"Want some bathtub rum?"
she asks. "How do you shower if that's in your tub?" I ask, swinging open the door. A neighbor who I share this with. She steps past me and pours us both a drink. That's followed by another, and a couple more as we chat. Ah, the German-Irish. Proof there is a God. "I tell you something about Will," she says. "He had the opportunity to make a lot of money elsewhere. His degree was in marketing, and he had offers at some big firms. But he wanted to make a difference. I remember him stopping one time at a brick wall of a building, and he said, 'You see that? My route is going to change. I have to go around this building. And why? Because some architect designed that and a bunch of people built it. Their actions have now affected my life, and it affects the lives of everyone who live and work inside it. Just think of how many thousands of people are affected by what they did.' I thought he was just going on another one of his tangents. He did that sometimes. But now I know that was his basic philosophy on life. He wanted to affect things the way that architect and those builders had. You know that one day they're going to tear down that building."
"Not the point, Griebel. I'm trying to make a point about integrity here. And I'm trying to get more of your bathtub booze. My neighbor calls it true juice."
"Pfft, that's disgusting."
"Why?"
"It sounds like you took a bath in it."
"You would think that.
Tell me I'm wrong."
"I'll tell you something else. The Overton driver, Enrico Lombardi, he's gonna go to jail tomorrow because of something someone else did, and he's not going to be able to afford a fancy lawyer like Thorndike, especially since Thorndike's the one who did it. My point is that he'll probably hang, and a lot of other people are dying out there in a gang war just because no one knows about this notebook. I know it's not what you were hired to do, and I wasn't hired to follow you around, yet here we are. We need to find out what that key opens and go get that notebook."
I take another swig of true juice before admitting to her that I know where it goes. Then I show it to her. We arrive at the train station comfortably inebriated. It's near midnight. The red-eye departures will be loading soon, so there are still people here, but less than most hours of the day. AJ notices a smell, then pushes me behind a wall. "What gives?" I ask.
"Thorndike," she tells me. "Right over there."
I peek around the corner and see him smoking one of his pretentious cigarettes. "He must be leaving to get away from the mayhem," I say. Then I recognize another familiar face further off, Enrico Lombardi, and a young, beautiful woman who looks like a youthful Betty Overton, probably her daughter. I tell AJ and speculate that they're probably running away from the law and her family. Who can blame them? But they'll never get away. The law, maybe, but never lots of money. "Well, it looks like the law is going to catch them before they leave," AJ says, pointing to some police officers who are just entering the station. I'm a little befuddled by this. I thought they'd wait until morning. But I move us onto the lockers. Maybe what we find will help them, as long as the couple doesn't resist arrest. We round the corner to the right locker, but I freeze. Two men are just past it. Though faced away, I still recognize them. They're the duo who killed Bill Wilson.
I decide not to tell AJ, but I have her stand between myself and them while I go to the locker and open it. She's too focused on the police arresting Enrico and his crying girlfriend to notice. Her inebriation has made her more emotional and she's tearing up. I can hear her breathing heavily. "Get a hold of yourself," I mutter, while I stumble with fitting the key into the keyhole. It takes me 7 tries, but it finally fits in. One of the 2 gangsters looks around and notices AJ holding back her tears. She does a double take and suddenly recognizes him, and her face goes pale. He realizes he's been had, and his face drops. I find the notebook along with a few other things, and I reach in to grab them. The gangster reaches into his jacket. "Dylan?" I hear her say. The gangster's eyes go from her to me. Then they grow wide as he spots the notebook. My eyes go wide as I drop the notebook. The world rocks slightly like we're on a boat. Damn, that's good bathtub rum. Just as the gangster's hand comes out with his gun, his partner taps him, pulling out his own gun. A group of rival gangsters across from them have pulled out their guns. A shotgun goes off, blowing back the partner into the lockers across from us. AJ and I get down. I scoop up the notebook, and the gangster who spotted us returns fire on his opponents. More mobsters join from both sides, and the police pull their weapons and fire on both of them. The civilians scream and run every direction. From our crouch position, I say it's time to go, but AJ stops me. "No, I'm going to get Enrico out of here." "What is it with you and that kid?" I ask. "Buildings, architects, change the world." I sigh. "Hold on a second." The gangster who fell against the lockers is dead and his partner has moved off for better cover. So I grab the dead gangster's gun and I toss it to AJ. I tell her, "He might still go to jail if I don't get Thorndyke. So you get the couple, I'll get the lawyer." She nods and we go our separate ways. I notice that Thorndyke is ducked into a gift shop. Going right at him would be through a gambit of gunfire, so I maneuver around the back of the lockers, heading toward the rails. I'm passing right behind gangsters and their barricades. I could take any of them out with a shot, but then I'd have the rest going at me. I continue on to the train platforms. I can see the other end of the gift shop. There's a window which Thorndyke is opening to climb out. I head toward him, beginning to raise my pistol. Then a gunshot is accompanied by the familiar sound like a hornet passing, the sort of sound I heard in the Great War when the fellow next to me went down. I turn to see the remaining gangster who took down Bill Wilson bearing down on me. I leap off the platform onto the rails and fire a few rounds back to force him into cover. Thorndyke climbs out the window and heads for the tracks. They are a line of pits with rail lines and raised platforms intermixed with the occasional engine or car. A distant hoot announces that another is on its way, probably the one Thorndyke was going to take. I hurry under the lip of the opposite side of the pit I'm in. The figure of the gangster appears with his gun raised at the hiding place I just left. I take a pair of shots, apparently nicking his shoulder as he flinches. He fires back and I leap onto the platform, dashing into one of the parked train cars. I spot Thorndyke through a window, leaping onto the engine of the same train. I run toward the front, getting into the next car which is attached to the engine. I hear a gunshot and glass break behind me. Looking back, I see the gangster entering the car I just left. Ahead, Thorndyke has left the engine and is making a break for the next rail pit over. I fire into the other train car hoping it will slow down the gangster, and I dash after Thorndyke. I hear a burst of shots behind me and I leap at my target. Hitting him, we both fall into the rail pit. I misjudge things a bit and I go flying past, hitting my head onto the far rail. Thorndyke falls on the nearer one. Panting and in pain, we stare at each other, him a little more confused. "You're gonna..." I start, but I'm too out of breath to finish. "You're gonna..." I try again, but I can't finish. A train whistle blows suddenly near us. We look over to see the train coming in on our rail. I climb out one way, he climbs out the other. I'm reminded of my inebriation as I struggle to get both legs up, and the second only just makes it. I see the gangster on the opposite side just before the engine goes by. Getting up, I see Thorndyke through the window in one direction, and the gangster through the window in another direction. I follow Thorndyke, and the gangster follows me. I take the moment to reload my gun. It's the only extra ammo I have, so the shots better pay off. The gangster takes the opportunity to shoot at me through the windows. One of his shots hits a passenger, and the other whizzes right by my face. I duck down so he can't see. I notice that the train is slowing and is nearing a stop. I grab onto the ladder at the edge of one of the cars and climb up. One of the passengers sees me, but I don't think the gangster did. Reaching the roof, I can see that he didn't. He's frantically searching the cars trying to find me. I stand up tall, taking careful aim, and as the train whistle blows, I take my shot. It lands solidly and takes him down. I sigh with relief, then remember what I'm doing there. Thorndike is running for it. I leap off the roof, then curse at the landing. It's the one area that being drunk helps me, though, as the pain is mitigated. I'll pay for it later. Right now, I chase after Thorndike. He's running for some stairs that go up to a bridge over the station. I'm panting and my lungs are burning as I pursue him up the stairs. But by the time we reach the top, my military training and his smoking habit come to terms, and I catch up with him. Before he can turn onto the bridge, I grab him and continue his momentum into the railing. His bell is rung, and I now have control over him. I throw him against another railing, this time tipping him slightly over the edge, and I lift him off his feet, nearly falling over the edge. "Who the hell are you?" Thorndike asks. "I'm the guy who's going to kill you unless you confess to manslaughter."
"What are you?"
"I have the notebook, Thorndike. I have everything Perugio is hiding from you. And now you're going to give me everything else I want, and you're going to turn yourself in."
"Or what?"
I physically remind him that I can throw him off the side or shoot him, but that's not really what he means. I can't threaten him past this train station. Or can I? There are a couple syndicates in there who would be happy to learn about this notebook. Their thugs may be killing each other, but their leaderships are intact. And wouldn't they love to learn that you were trying to skip town with it? Thorndike immediately got it and stopped struggling. "Manslaughter," I tell him. "Come up with your own excuses, and maybe you won't get the rope. Or I can save the good people of Lakefront the trouble and string you up right here." AJ got to Enrico and his girlfriend pretty easily, relatively speaking. She hid her gun and ran through screaming like a civilian. No one was targeting them, especially the cops. She led the couple away from the danger and outside. Enrico did have to go to jail for the night, but he was able to trade information on Thorndike in exchange for dropping charges on his fleeing from the law. Thorndike, knowing how to weasel his way through the law, was able to exchange the information he had for a lower sentence. Between his paperwork and the notebook, the puzzle came together. Enrico Lombardi and Linda Overton married a few weeks later. AJ Chu served as a bridesmaid in the grandiose wedding and covered the story for the paper. She also spiked all the drinks with Chu sauce. That left one loose end, the job for which I was paid to do. Betty Overton paid me well and brushed me off. A few nights later, after the will had been read by a new lawyer, and Betty had gained access to Arthur's bank accounts, she showed up at her regular appointment to pay Feynman. It was in the middle of the night at the Church of the Beloved Disciple. In front of the church is a small enclosed courtyard. There is a paved cobblestone walkway which forms a rough square around a fountain in the center. The entire courtyard is shielded from view on all sides by the 8-foot-high hedges, the perfect place for blackmail. Despite the paperwork having gone missing, he showed up anyway and tried to bluff his way through it to get the big payoff. She didn't let him. She told him that she would no longer be paying him, and then she pulled out a .38 and told him he would no longer be breathing. He tried to talk her down, and she shouted him down. He then begged for his life, and she smiled. That was what she wanted to see from the slimeball who had taken advantage of her youth, then beat her while they were married until she had no choice but to run. Now she was in control. She pulled the trigger. She doesn't understand. Gardner the butler had told her he had loaded it. He had never let her down before. How could this have happened? Feynman gets up from his knees, ready to charge Betty, but then a third figure appears, gun in hand. "This gun is loaded," I say. "Difference is, I'll let you surrender peacefully and leave town." "How did you..." Betty starts, and I tell her that I checked into her marriage before I returned the paperwork to her. Runaway waitress in a Nevada town meets sleazy gambler. Thinking she's got a catch, she marries him and even winds up pregnant. He takes off and she moves, catching the eye of a powerful middle-aged man. Within weeks, they're married, and wow, here's a son after 7 months. Charles. That's who all this is for. He's not a true heir. "Since this doesn't involve me, I'll just leave now," Feynman tries to say, but I cock the gun. "I saved your life tonight, Mr. Feynman, but if you ever show up in my city again, or if anything happens to Mrs. Overton over here, I will kill you myself." Feynman looks like he wants to protest, but he stops himself. He backs away and disappears into the dark. This has been a presentation of RPG Storytime, Gangbusters, a playthrough of Murder in Harmony by Mark Akers. Subscribe to the channel to hear more tales of RPG games, or check out our YouTube channel. The link is in the description. You can also read books by the writer and game master of these stories by going to bandwagononline.com. Join us next time as we bring you more tales from RPG tables across the globe. We hope you enjoyed it. and happy gaming, everybody.